Some of us think about what we eat only on holidays, some of us all the time, some of us, well, not at all. For those of you who would like to eat healthier but can't bear to hear about the latest fad diet, you're in luck. NPR's Art Silverman has some fresh advice for you.
Most people assume that even if they eat well, they won't be able to live for 1,000 years or forever. But they do want to stay healthy and happy for their entire lives, then die a painless and quick death doing something heroic. Is that too much to ask? So many people try to pay attention to what they eat. It becomes a religion to them. They set down rules. We sampled some people's rules in a Washington suburb to hear how they vary.
My food rule is that I'm really, really picky about my meat, like who's making it. I want to know where it's coming from.
I eat one thing on the plate at a time till it's gone, then I move on to the next. So I eat salad, then meat, then vegetables.
I usually avoid having pancakes or waffles or anything.
When it comes to sweets or cookies, I put them in my mouth, I taste it, then I spit it out.
I will only eat the food if I know exactly who has made that food.
I usually don't eat things out of plastic bags.
We're kind of lost in what has become a very treacherous food landscape. Eating has gotten really complex.
That's Michael Pollan. He's a crusader for changing the way we think about food, and he thinks we think about what we eat in ways that just don't make sense. He doesn't care much for those fads that create a mythology around proper ways to eat. He has a common sense slogan, which is, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Michael Pollan's latest book is called Food Rules.
This is a book that you can read in about 20 minutes or a half hour, and it's got 64 rules. Not all of them are going to stick. But my hope is that a couple will stick and that they will kind of be part of your bag of tricks when you enter the supermarket or the farmer's market. So I'm not expecting anyone to memorize 64 rules. In fact, a lot of them take you to the same place. You know, the rule, you know, don't eat anything that your grandmother wouldn't recognize as food is not so different than the rule that says don't eat any foods you've seen advertised on television.
And Michael Pollan suggests other common sense rules that are cloaked in humor. Here's rule 21.
It's not food if it's called by the same name in every language.
By that, Michael Pollan means Big Mac, Pringles, Cheetos. Rule 19.
If it came from a plant, eat it. If it was made in a plant, don't.
It's sort of like an extended Ten Commandments to keep you from straying from the path of wellness.
We do have a very religious view of food. Whenever we're eating, we think that this activity takes place on a spectrum, at one end of which is we're ruining our health because we're eating the junk we want to eat, and at the other end of the spectrum, we're redeeming our health. And I really think that that's a shame because in my own experience, the best food for your health is the most pleasurable food, and there is not a trade-off between eating well and eating pleasurably.
But in truth, people stumble way outside the orthodoxy of food rules. And by publishing this book, Michael Pollan sets himself up to be thought of as a high priest of eating right. When word got around NPR that Michael Pollan had food rules, colleagues who strayed felt the need to confess. The first was reporter Ari Shapiro.
Forgive me, Michael Pollan, for I have committed a food sin. I was just in Austin, Texas, and I drowned in queso.
You know, I'm not sure that that does break the rules. I'd have to see the recipes. If it's really Velveeta, my attitude is don't eat foods that are pretending to be something they're not.
Well, thank you for absolving me of my food sin.
Next into the confessional booth was producer Neil Carruth.
Forgive me, Michael Pollan, but I've committed the food sin of eating way too much candy.
Candy. It's a special occasion food. It's a treat. Don't stop eating candy, but just think about when you have it and if you can put it back up on its pedestal of being special.
And finally, our cake lady came by, producer Melissa Gray, author of All Cakes Considered.
Forgive me, Michael Pollan, for I have sinned. In addition to the cake that I push on the staff every Monday, I also have a weakness, an indulgence, for Chef Boyardee beef ravioli in a can.
Now that's nasty.
No, it's not.
Well, you know, if you enjoy Chef Boyardee beef ravioli and I don't, that's fine. It's fine. But I've also been to the feedlots where that meat was produced. That's, you know, the little bit of it that's in the middle of those things. And, you know, I have a little more trouble with it than you do. You know, I really don't like this role of being food superego to people like you. I'm really sorry. But there is no one proper way to eat, and anyone who tells you that is crazy.
Unlike the tablets that came down from Mount Sinai, Michael Pollan includes one final commandment Moses never thought of.
Rule number 64 is you should break the rules from time to time.
Amen. That's Michael Pollan. The book is Food Rules, wisdom for those among us who tend to eat food. Art Silverman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Passover is right around the corner, and over the next few weeks, hundreds of thousands of pounds of matzah will ship to grocery stores everywhere. A few batches of this plain-tasting cracker always sell out first because they contain shmurah matzah. What's that you say? Jean Barron reports.
The pressure is on at the Manischewitz Baking Factory in Newark, New Jersey. This is the day Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz, dressed in a white overcoat and wearing a grimace of joy and stress, oversees the production of shmurah, or watched matzah. All matzah is bread made without yeast, but shmurah matzah is guarded by the watchful eyes of a team of rabbis from the field to the oven. Their job? Prevent any trace of water mixing with the flour until the last minutes before baking.
The very basic of kosher matzah rule requires that it goes from the mixing area to the oven in less than 18 minutes.
Jewish religious leaders say 18 minutes of contact between flour and water is about as long as you can go before fermentation sets in. A few religious leaders are on hand at the industrial bakery.
Are we ready to start the process?
Yes, that's all.
Taking a cue from Rabbi Horowitz, two rabbis give a blessing, press a button next to a silver mixing cauldron, and watch.
Yes, live it. Yes, that's it.
Rabbi Simcha Katz says shmurah matzah stands out in his childhood memories.
I remember going to the Boston Rebbe. A group of people of us, young people, were rolling it, and then the rabbi himself put it into the oven. And watching it, and said, wow, this is really exciting. And that matzah had a special taste.
Simcha and the others watch the high-tech machines press out a ribbon of dough. Suddenly, an official matzah maker opens a gate on the conveyor belt, and just-cut squares of dough fall into a trap right before they go in the oven. The rabbis say these matzot are not up to snuff.
Matzahs are going to trash. They're torn, they're broken, they're folded over.
This is, you see, it's like double. It's not baking good. Да, проблема залипает. In a few minutes we'll be okay.
Soon the familiar squares are rolling again. Manischewitz and other matzah makers bust out as much as 60% of their product line in the weeks before Passover. High stress?
Very, very.
That's Manischewitz head of sales, Kevin O'Brien.
I refer to it as, for me, it's PPS, pre-Passover syndrome. In layman's terms, it's like our Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, and Hanukkah all rolled into one.
Manischewitz shmurah matzah is heading to Seder tables from Canada to Argentina in the coming weeks. As for the matzah dough that didn't pass muster, it'll end up in animal feed. For NPR News, I'm Jean Barron.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. 1 week after his dramatic televised meeting with Republicans, President Obama effectively acknowledged the obvious. If there's going to be a health care bill this year, it's going to happen exclusively with Democratic votes. The president gave a speech to a group of doctors and nurses in the White House East Room. He said the debate is over, and he said it's time for Congress to send him a bill. The only way to get it past unanimous Republican opposition will be to use a budget maneuver that limits Republican power, and we'll have more on that in a moment. We start with NPR's Julie Rovner on the president's plan.
On Tuesday, the president reached out to Republicans by including several of their ideas in the proposal he wants Congress to pass. But in yesterday's speech, he made it clear that he won't accept their threshold demand to start the process over.
I don't see how another year of negotiations would help.
And he picked apart their other major argument, that it would be better and more politically acceptable to do a health overhaul in small pieces.
The problem with that approach is that unless everyone has access to affordable coverage, you can't prevent insurance companies from denying coverage based on pre-existing conditions. You can't limit the amount families are forced to pay out of their own pockets. The insurance reforms rest on everybody having access to coverage.
And perhaps most important, people without insurance end up costing everyone more when they use the emergency room for non-emergency care.
So the fact is, health reform only works if you take care of all of these problems at once.
Republicans, however, were so prepared for what the president was going to say, they actually gave some of their reactions in advance of the speech. Here's House Minority Leader John Boehner yesterday morning, well before the afternoon event at the White House.
Well, it's pretty clear that the Obama administration and my colleagues in Congress are going to continue on their march to shove this government-run health care plan down the throats of the American people. You can't add a couple of Republican sprinkles on the top of a 2,700-page bill and claim that it's bipartisan.
Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell pointed out that without Republican support, Democrats will have a difficult path ahead. House Democrats, for example, will have to pass the bill the Senate passed on Christmas Eve, complete with all the individual deals cut to get that measure through.
House Democrats only are going to be called upon to vote on a bill that has the Cornhusker kickback, the Louisiana Purchase, the Gator Aid, and all the rest.
Those are the special favors to benefit Nebraska, Louisiana, and Florida. Democrats hope to erase those special deals with a second bill using a budget technique that would let them sidestep a potential Senate filibuster. But McConnell warned that even if Democrats manage that, the debate will be far from over.
Because every election in America this fall will be a referendum on this issue. And there's an overwhelming likelihood that every Republican candidate will be campaigning to repeal it.
But defending a health bill that actually becomes law is a prospect many Democrats relish. At the Democrats news conference, Maryland Senator Ben Cardin said Democrats are happy to debate the prospect of something versus nothing. And when it comes to health care, he said, nothing is really what Republicans want, despite their claims to the contrary.
The Republicans do not want a health care bill. It's not that they want us to start over. They don't want a health care bill. And the Democrats believe it is time to act.
And time, it seems, is of the essence. Democrats had hoped to be long since done with the health care bill. They want to refocus their legislative efforts on jobs and the economy. Now Democratic leaders, with the help of President Obama, who'll stump for the health bill in Philadelphia and St. Louis next week, have to convince wavering moderates that it will be more in their interest to pass this health care bill than to let the effort die. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Napoleon once said that an army marches on its stomach. Turns out that all kinds of troops need care and feeding, including movie makers with their long hours and tight schedules. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg presents her annual pre-Oscar series, Hollywood Jobs, with the role of craft service.
Movies just love food. Making food.
Don't be afraid.
No fear, Julia.
Take your knife. Confront the duck.
Serving food.
Well, the spaghetti comes without meatballs.
There are no meatballs with the spaghetti?
No, sometimes spaghetti likes to be alone.
Or scaring you to death with it.
I do wish we could chat longer, but I'm having an old friend for dinner.
Have a light.
Any vegetables? Off screen, the army of movie makers must eat. And on any set, it's up to craft service to feed them.
Well, today I set up a little breakfast, something, a little coffee to get people going.
Servicing not so much the stars, but the crew, the craft workers, gaffers, prop masters, costumers, electricians. Craig Conover began in craft service years back. Now he works at their local union.
The actor that makes $20 million a film, they can have fresh lobster flown in every day. That's not the problem. But it's the guy that's hauling around the lights and the camera. They need that sustenance so that they can do the 14, 16-hour days in some reasonable amount of comfort.
In the old days, craft service didn't do food. Movie folks either ate in the commissary or brought in brown bag sandwiches. Even big stars did that. Humphrey Bogart, maybe, Gary Cooper. Then Hollywood became big business. Work days lengthened. People wanted pizza to tide them over.
You know, who's going to order the pizza? Well, we'll have the craft service guy do it.
That's how their food duties began. They've always done all the odd jobs. Craft service sweeps up broken glass after a movie car crash or fake ash from a volcano. Craig tells an old saw about the movie elephant who divests itself of a meal on location. Someone nearby runs over to clean it up.
And the craft service guy stops him and says, No. It may look like crap to you, but it's my bread and butter.
Tomatoes, carrots, broccoli.
Charlie Scott, craft service on the film Burlesque, has been buying the bread and butter, the veggies, the hot dogs for movies for 15 years. First thing every day, 6 days a week, 57-year-old Charlie pushes a cart through a supermarket.
It doesn't matter what time I get off. I get what you call a wake-up call at my house at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Cottage cheese and strawberry.
You gonna buy any chocolate?
Everyone eats chocolate.
And this is just the morning snack. The hot movie meals, breakfast, lunch, supper, are done by a caterer. Charlie Scott is Mr. Between Meals, Mr. Food on the Run. His morning shopping cart runneth over, $260.67 worth of in-between. By day's end, he will have spent $1,000 to feed 250 people. That's nothing. Charlie did craft service on an Adam Sandler football film with thousands of extras in the stands.
It was called The Longest Yard. We had 5,000 background a day for 30 days. That's not even including the crew. In the summer months, I had a crew just for water. I had another crew with just to clean up. I had another crew with just food.
Can you take this out for me, Gibson?
Fewer mouths to feed on today's shoot. At Sony Pictures Studio in Culver City, Charlie hauls the groceries into his trailer.
And this is a craft service truck.
This is my prep area.
Burlesque, the film he's servicing, stars Christina Aguilera, Stanley Tucci, Cher. She has her own chef, but comes to Charlie's table, too. He says she eats lots of veggies and drinks water from glass bottles only, no plastic.
Good morning.
They're shooting on Soundstage 23. When it was MGM, Fred Astaire and Paul Newman worked here. Just off the set, Charlie and his son, Charles Scott III, fill long tables with platters.
We have a fruit basket, bananas, apples, chips, bagels, peanuts, Cracker Jacks. There's also cookies.
One of the dancers in Burlesque inspects the offerings.
You're very scantily clad. I can't believe
yes.
You eat anything here because you're very slim as well.
I actually eat a lot, surprisingly.
She'll dance it off on the set.
Stairs out on the front now.
It's a once grand burlesque club. Lots of gilding, a silk swagged stage, round cabaret tables with little lamps. The light is soft and sexy. Back in the food trailer, Charlie Scott is making a smoothie for someone who's not feeling well.
Strawberries, blueberries, banana, giving her some natural fruit. Natural fruit.
A little Mother Nature healing from Mr. Craft Service. Then it's time to get the next round of snacks going.
What would you like me to do, Dad?
Give me a bag of mangoes, a bag of apples.
Charlie's put two sons through college.
Yep.
Charlie III has worked for his father for 9 years.
So it's going to be a dynasty. You'll inherit the business one day, maybe.
Similar to the Ming, yes. Similar to the Ming dynasty. But you know what? I love what I do. I'm very passionate about feeding people.
It's a family passion and the reason Glenn Gaynor of Sony's Screen Gems division hires Charlie Scott.
Yep.
Glenn says the hardworking Charlie is good for the stomach and the psyche.
He's definitely the first person on the set, and he's got to make sure that when everybody struggles their way at 6 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning to the set, that the coffee's on and the coffee's hot. And Charlie is always smiling and he's always happy to see you, and he gets your day going. Both heart and mind and soul and spirit are all taken care of in that truck.
How are we doing today? This guy loved tuna. He loved tuna.
Keep the food coming, keep the place clean, keep up the shout-outs.
Hey, Peter.
Mr. Craft Service Charles Scott II keeps this long day going and starts all over again tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow.
Bon appétit!
In Movie Land, I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
The pre-Oscar series concludes tomorrow with some of the secrets behind the special effects of Avatar. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Scandals have brought down two prominent politicians in recent days. New York Governor David Paterson called off his re-election campaign. He faces allegations that one of his state troopers tried to block an investigation of the governor's aide. Now he faces even more questions about accepting World Series tickets. Congressman Charles Rangel gave up a powerful chairmanship amid an ethics investigation. Their problems are different, but in a way they're part of one story. They are both New Yorkers, both African American, and both have links to Harlem, which was once a center of black political power. NPR News analyst Juan Williams is in New York this morning, joins us from the NPR Bureau there. Juan, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
How are they connected to Harlem?
Well, it's very interesting. Congressman Rangel has represented Paterson's district in Harlem for 20 terms. So they have the same roots of black political power, which is really the center of black political power in the United States. David Paterson's dad, Basil Paterson, was one of the leading black politicians in New York for years, along with Congressman Charlie Rangel, former Mayor David Dinkins, Percy Sutton, who was the former Manhattan Borough President. It was called the Harlem Clubhouse since about the 1960s. And David Paterson's dad was the first black Secretary of State, was also in the New York State Senate. Rangel, for his part, went on, of course, to become one of the founders of the Congressional Black Caucus, the first black person on the House Ways and Means Committee, which, of course, writes tax policy, so it's quite powerful. And I think it's important to note here that Charlie Rangel succeeded Adam Clayton Powell, and Adam Clayton Powell represented that district from the 1940s to the 1970s when he was ousted by a young reformer, Charlie Rangel, and a new face of black politics in America.
So two very prominent African-Americans here. You know, Juan, we had some discussion of that last night on Twitter, NPR Inskeep, and one of the questions I asked was why, I was asked actually, was why does it matter that they're African-American? How is that part of their ethical trouble here?
It's not. I think, you know, clearly race is always a factor in American politics. But in a way, this is a story of black politics in the age of Obama, Steve. Congressman Rangel's really decision yesterday to step down as chairman of House Ways and Means was evidence of flagging support from fellow Democrats, but in specific inside the Congressional Black Caucus, especially from younger members, people like Arthur Davis, the congressman from Alabama, who just said the weight of this ethics probe was too much and contributed or offered Republicans leverage to claim there was now a culture of corruption among Democrats. Kind of action, I don't think you would have seen in a previous age.
Do you think in past decades that African-Americans would have circled around their own?
Absolutely. And I think it would have been really telling because, as remember, that Charlie Rangel is the dean of black politics in Congress and such a revered figure here in New York. And similarly, I think in the case of Governor Paterson, the New York Times, I can't imagine the New York Times taking on the first black governor of the state in the way that they have been doing at this moment before this age of Obama.
Juan, very briefly, is this in some way a sign of progress? Minority politicians get the same chance as everybody else to be knocked down over their ethical trouble?
Well, I don't think it's new that they get knocked down, Steve, but I think that the idea that other black people don't circle in quite the same way, that they don't have that same level of protection, is a new day in terms of American politics. And I think in the case of Charlie Rangel, it has come as a rude wake-up call at the end of his career, and it's almost Shakespearean in its epic and tragic dimensions.
Juan, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Steve.
That's NPR News analyst Juan Williams speaking with us this morning from New York City. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.